and it's sometimes quite obvious to everybody that this anxiety is there, because it takes a lot of mental energy to maintain these kinds of concealment. So here, in this instance we're looking at, with Ramachandrapuri, so he was conversant enough with the philosophy of Krishna consciousness to understand that he had made a major aparat, but he didn't want to admit it. So now he's engaging in all these other things. Notice he hasn't exactly left the society of devotees. He could have said, he could have socialized himself to another group. But somehow or other he's maintaining the same, he wants to be respected by, he wants the respect of the Vaishnavas, and wants to consider himself an advanced devotee. But the main requirement for such advancement, that is, pleasing one's spiritual master and receiving his mercy, on this he was a notable failure. Because actually, one of the last acts of the spiritual master was to kick him out of his association. So somehow or other, now he's preserving his self-respect. If you sat down and asked him, oh, I can't remember what happened, or there was a little incident, you know, he wouldn't be able to, if you forced him to talk about what happened between him and his Guru Maharaj at that time, he would get very vague, and he actually wouldn't be able to think about it very clearly, you know. But in a way, he's not conscious of what he's doing, but he's definitely responsible for doing it. He's made himself unconscious. You see, to keep yourself unconscious like this, this requires psychic energy. And so there's always a lot of tension in people who are in this state of being. So anyway, so his idea was now to become a critic. So you see these things here that are listed here. There's fault finding, punctiliousness, intolerance. That is intolerance of others, and also self-importance. Bluffing. We'll discuss bluffing a little more in detail there, with the idea of self-importance. He considers himself now, by acting in this way, he's announcing to everybody that he's the senior of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, because he's Guru Varga. You see, the god brother of your guru is Guru Varga, on the same level as your spiritual master. So he is Guru Varga, and so he's letting everybody know this. Now, there's an interesting thing about how Chaitanya Mahaprabhu dealt with this. So after he accused Chaitanya Mahaprabhu to his face of having sugar candy in his room because of the presence of ants, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu could understand that what he'd heard about Ramachandrapuri was true. So then he called his servant and said, from now on, I shall accept a fourth pot of Jagannath's prasad and 5 gandhas worth of vegetables. If you bring any more than this, you'll not see me here anymore. So he was cutting down his food intake. Govinda relayed this message to all the devotees. When they heard it, they felt as if their heads had been struck by thunderbolts. All the devotees condemned Ramachandrapuri. This sinful man has come here and taken our lives, they said. Okay. I'll do. What, wait a second, we're at 2:15. No, it's okay, we're okay. That's fine. So that day a Brahmin extended an invitation to Chaitanya. When he accepted, when Govinda would accept only 5 gandhas worth of vegetables and 1/4 pot of rice, the Brahmin, in great despair, struck his head with his hands and cried, "Alas, alas." Everybody really relished feeding Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, and now he won't eat. And then Chaitanya Mahaprabhu only ate half of that and gave the rest to Govinda. Thus both Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and Govinda ate only half the food they needed. Because of this, all the other devotees gave up eating. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu ordered Govinda and Kashishwara, "You may both take alms elsewhere to fill your bellies." In this way, some days passed in great unhappiness. Hearing of all this, Ramachandrapuri went to Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, now notice Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu offered his obeisances to Ramachandrapuri, worshipping his feet. Then Ramachandrapuri smiled and spoke to the Lord. Ramachandrapuri advised, "It is not the business of a sannyasi to gratify his senses. He should fill his belly some way or other. I have heard that you have cut your eating in half. Indeed, I see that you are skinny. Such dry renunciation is also not the religion of a sannyasi. So damned if you do, damned if you don't," right? "A sannyasi eats as much as necessary to maintain his body, but he does not enjoy satisfying his senses materially. Thus, a sannyasi becomes perfect in his spiritual advancement and knowledge." And he quotes from the 16th chapter of Bhagavad Gita. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu then humbly submitted, "I am just like an ignorant boy, and I'm like your disciple. It is my great fortune that you are instructing me." Hearing this, Ramachandrapuri got up and left. He also heard from various sources that all the devotees of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu were eating half as much as usual. The next day, Paramananda Puri and the other devotees approached Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu in great humility and submission. Paramananda Puri said, "My godbrother, Ramachandrapuri, is by nature a bad critic." He's a critic by nature. "If you give up eating because of his words, what will be the profit? It is the nature of Ramachandrapuri that first he lets one eat as much as he desires, and if one does not eat more than necessary, with great attention he makes him eat more. In this way he induces everyone to eat, one to eat more than necessary, then he directly criticizes him, saying, 'You eat so much, how much money do you have in your treasury?' Also, by inducing sannyasis to eat so much, you spoil their religious principles. I can understand that you have no advancement. It is Ramachandrapuri's business to inquire always how others are eating and conducting their affairs daily." These two kinds of activities rejected in the revealed scriptures constitute his daily affairs. And there's a quotation from Srimad Bhagavatam. "One should see that because of the meeting of material nature and the living entity, the universe is acting uniformly. Thus one should neither praise nor criticize the characteristics or activities of others." And of the two rules, Ramachandrapuri obeys the first by abandoning praise, but although he knows the second is more prominent, he neglects it by criticizing others. So he doesn't praise anyone, but he criticizes everybody. So he's saying he doesn't want to criticize Ramachandrapuri either, but he says he has to say something against him because he's making our hearts unhappy. "Why have you given up proper eating due to criticism of Ramachandrapuri? Please accept invitations as before. This is the request of all of us." Chaitanya Mahaprabhu replied, "Why are you angry at Ramachandrapuri? He's expounding the natural principles of sannyas life. Why are you accusing him? For a sannyasi to indulge in satisfying the tongue is a great offense. The duty of a sannyasi is to eat only as much as needed to keep body and soul together." When they all requested very fervently that Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu take a full meal, he still would not do so. Instead, he responded to their request by accepting half as much as usual. So then he goes into some details how he cut down. As he mentioned, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu sometimes accepted Ramachandra Puri as his master and considered himself a servant. And sometimes the Lord, not caring for him, would see him being just like a straw. Then when Ramachandra Puri left, it says the devotees considered Ramachandra Puri to be like a great burden on their heads. When he left Jagannath Puri, everyone felt extremely happy. And then Chaitanya Mahaprabhu accepted invitations as usual and took prasadam with everybody. If one spiritual master rejects him, one becomes so fallen that he, like Ramachandra Puri, commits offenses even to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu did not consider the offenses of Ramachandra Puri, for the Lord considered him a spiritual master. However, his character instructed everyone about the results of offending the spiritual master. So that's the story. So what one needs to notice here is that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, when one is the object of criticism, the Vaishnava thing is just to accept it as well meant, even though it may be badly meant. And the other thing is that Ramachandra Puri observed the etiquette very nicely. That Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, because Ramachandra Puri was Guru Varga, he simply accepted him that way. So he didn't really rock the boat. So the reason I'm going over all of these different things, we were looking at these kinds of reaction modes, especially the ones that are arrested. If we get to know what Boysen is talking about, we can understand these manifestation of these things in different places. One, in ourselves. Two, in other people. And three, sometimes in groups or institutions. And so the question is, how do we deal with it? Well, first of all, of course, one has to deal with it in oneself. The biggest mistake a Vaishnava can make, one of the biggest mistakes, I should modify, many big mistakes, is to try to purify other people without first purifying himself. And this is, sometimes it becomes necessary that a devotee has to see the fault of another devotee. Now, ordinarily, one shouldn't want to do that. But if sometimes you're in a position of authority over somebody else, or sometimes Prabhupada's mission will be harmed, and you have to do it. But the general rule is that if there's going to be any purification going on of anybody, if you're not trying to purify yourself of anarthas or difficulties, and at the same time you're trying to purify other people without engaging in it yourself, it's going to blow up in your face. It'll just come right back on you. It's not that one has to be pure in order to sometimes see the deal with somebody else's impurities. But one has to be in the honest process of becoming pure. Now, one of the things I gave you to read, I don't know if you've read it yet, but this is part of the application part of this thing, is this, there's a couple of essays, this next step in the expansion of ISKCON, ending the fratricidal war. There's a date on here, 1984. And this was written, this was the paper I wrote at the request of the North America, part of the request of the North American Temple Presidents. And this was the paper that happened to have started up what became known as the Guru Reform Movement. It started in 84 and ended in 87. And I ended up being a leader of this movement. And by Krishna's grace, I somehow had the realization right in the very beginning, and it's talked about in that paper, that if we were going to start criticizing other people or the institution of ISKCON, those people who were doing it had themselves had to be dealing with their own faults and anarthas. And I saw there were many people involved in this movement. And in the course of it, just at the end, by the thing finished, there were many gurus who left their position. Not that anybody was removed by our reform movement. They all kind of got removed by the material energy in the process of the thing. But there were also people who were leaders in the so-called reform movement who also fell away from ISKCON. And those were precisely the people who themselves had the same faults that they were criticizing in others and weren't doing anything about it. They had the same faults and they weren't doing anything about it. If they had the same faults and they were doing something about it, that would have been different. So this is, it becomes a delicate matter when one is dealing with people who are in a superior position than you are, somebody senior. You see what Chaitanya Mahaprabhu did, he just really wouldn't deal with it at all. He was very careful and just observed the etiquette. And generally, that's what we should do. Of course, we have methods of dealing with things in ISKCON of going to the appropriate people and trying to get appropriate people to do something if there's something going wrong. And that we feel that maybe some effect of this kind of arrested development some of these devices have caused a problem, and we can do something. There's different ways we can do something about it. But the point I want to make, at least for today, is that the first person that we have to use any insight we've gained is ourselves. One cannot purify others or help others make spiritual advancement if we ourselves are not on the path of advancement. In other words, we have to be frank, or come to the platform of frankness, and have to be growing toward our end. We have to be making spiritual progress. And then we can help other people. And even if it becomes delicate, actually, if we're rightly situated, Krishna will give us the intelligence how to do this. Because what will happen, what happens over the course of time, this dharma shaglani, is these compromise and concealment devices will always have the tendency to build up, just like barnacles on a ship's hull. And if they build up so much so that the ship can't move, then there'll be an upheaval. If you look at what Gaudiya Vaishnavism was like, when Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur went to town, you'll see it as a whole mass of concealment devices. People, for example, when people say that I have the ability to give Krishna consciousness to somebody else simply because of birth, the Nityananda Vamsas, the Jati Gosais, what is that? You see, that's a device where what I really have to do to become Krishna conscious is this. To be on the highest level of Krishna consciousness is this. But I'm not going to do this, so I've substituted something else. I'm born in the right family and we're the ones that have this ability. So when that becomes very prominent, and those and that concealment reaction is there, somebody like Bhakti Siddhanta has to come along and, you know, blow the whole ship out of the water. Because of the human nature, it's going to happen. Now, what should really happen in this con is that we're just like, you know, in the Navy, because the, you know what barnacles are, those sea creatures that get on the hull of ships? You know, you see the mussels and little, and they slow a ship down. So what's usually done is you don't let them build up. You're constantly scrubbing. You know, every week somebody has to go down there and rub these creatures off of the hull of the ship. If you're not constantly scrubbing, then they build up, and then, you know, your ship will come lose speed, and then it becomes a huge job. So if you're constantly scrubbing, then you won't go through these big cycles of decline and revival and decline and revival, ups and downs, you know. So that's what we're hoping, that in our ISKCON society, if we're constantly scrubbing, we have a saying quoted in a political context in America, but it applies to Krishna consciousness. Eternal vigilance is the price of liberty. You know, you always have vigilance, meaning being awake and watching, being alert all the time. So in Krishna consciousness, you can never think, well, now we've succeeded. Now the Krishna consciousness movement is pure. Now we've gotten rid of this anartha or that anartha or this malformation or that malformation, and now we're okay. As soon as you think there's no danger, you're in danger. And so Prabhupada told us that he himself was always praying to Krishna, please don't let me fall into Maya. So as an institution, we have to be thinking that at any minute we can lose it. As soon as we become complacent and self-satisfied, you can be sure that these reactions are going to be building up. Because we, as long as we hold out this high standard of Krishna consciousness, people are very attracted to the purity of Krishna consciousness. But they then want to possess that purity without paying the full price for it. I shouldn't say they, I should say we. The tendency is always there to find some way. And so described here. So this is Ramachandrapuri. In this case, he wanted to be known as a great devotee. So everything that he's talking about him, the maintenance of self-respect, through depreciation of others and maintaining primary loyalties through substitution of minor for major virtues. See, he was keeping the sannyas order pure, right? That was his thing. He was on a crusade. But his thing was, you know, a couple of things, you know, not eat too much and eat too little, and he became obsessed with what people were doing to eat. So this is what Boysen has talked about. One becomes very punctilious in the tithing of anise, mint, and cumin because he's as a cover-up for being neglectful in the larger matters of the law. It's the same thing he's talking about. That's clear? Yeah?
Maybe I'm jumping ahead, but it seems that a lot of the concealment that's taken place in ISKCON has been at least one of the maybe been the most conspicuous and caused the most problems are amongst those in leadership positions who somehow or other haven't been able to keep up the mark. Now,
yeah, well, it's most noticeable, obviously, in leadership position.
questions. It seems a bit like a catch-22. One could be sincerely endeavoring as a leader to do a service to Prabhupada, and then he makes a mistake. He falls as a fall down.
Yeah.
Now, probably the most correct thing to do would be to admit that.
Yeah. But one feels one can't.
Well, there's the momentum that, and it's.
That's a more intricate problem. We can get into that, what to do in the case of leaders. But, you're getting ahead. Yeah. Because Prabhupada had ways to deal with that, you know. To admit a fall down doesn't mean necessarily one has to tell the whole world. But one has to at least have to undergo some place of rectification among the right people. And that was generally Prabhupada's policy. He didn't want people to be so ashamed that they became useless. You know. But what Prabhupada did, he was protecting the Krishna consciousness movement. When the GBC does it, it's covering up. You know. So sometimes we can't even do what Prabhupada did. Because once there was a sannyasi that had a fall down and it was broadcast over all over the place, and Prabhupada was very upset. The devotees were talking about it.
Said you've ruined his chances. You ruined
his chances for coming back. That was Prabhupada's policy. If the GBC were to do something like that and were found out, we'd be accused of a cover-up, maintaining hypocrisy. So we may not be able to do that sometimes, because there's a difference between Prabhupada and the current GBC. The difference is Prabhupada could do no wrong. And the GBC could do no right, at least in some people's eyes. So if we did the same thing Prabhupada did, we'd really get in trouble.
There's a letter where one leader's fallen down. He was married, fell down with some other woman. Prabhupada wrote him a letter saying, leave the woman, leave the place at once, go back to your wife, don't tell anybody about it.
Yeah. But, you know, he had obviously made his confession to Prabhupada. So there's different considerations that are involved here, and some of them are policy considerations and not really germane to our class here. But Prabhupada sometimes not want it to at least be shouted from the rooftops and published in ISKCON World Review. Although some people think that's what's meant by confession. That's not. I don't really want to talk about this. I want to go on with it. Okay, yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah. In that situation, when he leaves, it's likely he comes back. So the problem is not really finished, right?
No, it's not really finished. It says sometimes Chaitanya Mahaprabhu wouldn't care for him, and sometimes he acted like... But Chaitanya wanted to show at least Chaitanya Mahaprabhu really wanted to observe the proper, show us the way, at least personally, one should take criticism. It's directed at oneself. And we should be very careful if studying this stuff with boys and makes us understand some faults in other people that we didn't notice before. If we become fault finders, we'll be misusing this. So one should be careful. Ishani?
Besides guru and temple learning, should there be other persons who can guide the devotees with their problems?
Besides gurus?
Yeah. If you have a guru, you can tell your problem to your guru.
Yeah.
Or temple learning.
Yeah. Yeah. Can there be someone else? Yeah, of course.
Yeah, but in many temples, I think they're not an established counseling office. One time I spoke with one of the workers who came from New Vrindavan. She said in New Vrindavan actually they had that.
Yeah, they had some institutionalized system like that. If generally there should be people. Every devotee should have somebody actually that they can turn to that is, they consider more advanced, or at least not even sufficiently advanced to give good direction and advice. Now, you can formally institute that if you have a Brahminical class of people established in some way, then you can say that these are, you know, people we recognize as counselors. But it doesn't always have to be a formal arrangement. Because the formal arrangement, why not? It doesn't have to be. Why doesn't it have to be? Suppose it's just that you have somebody that you go to, maybe god brother or god sister, that you go to as somebody from whom you get shiksha or counseling or direction or things like that. It's just called friendship. You don't have to have designated institutional friends. Especially that kind of friend that's called suhrit. Not mitra, but suhrit, a well-wishing friend. Somebody maybe on a little higher level, that you consider on a higher level, who can give guidance and direction. If you can institutionalize it, very well, that's fine if you have the people. But if it's not institutionalized, still it can be there. Yeah?
So a person that's born in Hindu Nandabam actually believes that you have to be born in it to have the realization, then how can that be concealment? Like, they actually believe it. Like, you can actually believe that you have to be born into it to get the love of God. I don't
know
how that's concealment, but they actually believe it.
No. What happens along the line, maybe somebody now born into it is just believes it. But originally it developed as a concealment device and then gets passed down as just the truth. But if they studied enough scriptures, they may recognize it and take advantage of it also. Because concealment means on a certain level you know the truth, but on another level you're keeping yourself from being aware. Before you came in, I was talking about the amount of psychic energy it takes to keep this stuff sometimes under wraps. Stuff that you almost know but don't really let yourself be fully conscious of, but it troubles you. Let's go through a few more of these terms here. So he talks about compromise with this cynicism. We talked about what cynicism means. Fault-finding. On the top level, in the isolation, he has the misanthrope. Misanthrope, one who hates or distrusts humankind, a hater of humanity, is a misanthrope. Yeah? Well, when you're isolated, you don't have friends. That's a fact.
Where you go with your problems?
You don't want to go anywhere with your problems because you think everyone's a creep.
No, you won't.
That's not what we're talking about here with isolation. We're talking about loneliness, which is a different thing. Isolation here is meant when you're lonely is one thing. Lonely means you want to have friends and you don't have any. Isolate means you don't want to have any friends because you think nobody's good enough to be my friend. This is the misanthrope. You know, you have this in normal life. If anybody who grew up in a small town always knows there's one or two odd characters who live by themselves, who never got married, that are weird. That the little kids sometimes call he's Crazy Joe or something like that. They're hermits. They're eccentrics. Sometimes they write long letters to the editor. You know, all they do is they write letters to newspaper. They spend all their time writing. Right now they got an email like crazy. These guys that never go out, never meet anybody. They call in the United States. They call in on talk radio shows. Cranks, often. They have some cause they focus on. Often there's paranoid. You know, do you understand the people I am talking about? And they like to talk politicians because they're convinced every single politician is a liar, a cheater, a thief. Or they believe, so a misanthrope really has one who has this whole opinion of humanity
Matt?
And also, we'll have within our society, we'll have people who, you know, they're absolutely convinced that every single devotee is a fraud. That there's not a single pious person in ISKCON. Huh? Cynicism, yeah. Yeah. Sure. Have you ever met those people? Yeah. Huh? You go to America.
It seems like these people aren't actually, they're not actually thinking everybody's so bad. It's just that they're actually thinking this about themselves. So the way they deal with it is by rejecting everybody else.
Well, yeah, but then the thing is, they don't think that they're so bad. But I think everybody else.
The thing deep down inside.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about. It's concealed. Deep down inside, it's themselves they're worried about. They can't face it. They don't want to handle it. They maintain their self-respect, and they end up projecting it on other people. Because underneath it, they're maintained, so there's pride. And they think, like, what's going on is deep inside, he says, I know I'm really fallen. But I know I'm better than all these other guys. So they must be really, really, really fallen. I mean, I saw this when I first started to get in arguments with these Ritvik people. These were people who were, this first group of Ritvik people centered around Nityananda, was a group of people who were seriously compromised in their spiritual life. I mean, their basic spiritual life.
How many wives did Nityananda?
Anyway, I don't want to. They were, and it was, you know, and it came out later anyway. At first it was a little hidden, but then when somebody ran away with somebody else's wife, I forgot the whole thing, but anyway, they were seriously compromised in their spiritual life. But they were convinced that there was nobody who was qualified to be a guru. You could see what it was. I'm not qualified to be a guru, therefore nobody is qualified, because how can these people... And there was also this dumba, this which we're going to talk about, bluffing, this puffed up self-importance. Because it flipped around, they were going to instruct all of us about guru tattva. No one was qualified to be guru except these people who were going to tell all of us what the real principle of guru was, you know. So they turned it right around again. So this is, and there was this kind of collective judgment. So every time you hear this, you know, ISKCON is no good, or this, or that, the other thing, or all the devotees are cheaters, you know, you can see this reaction is taking place. And it's just, you know, it's just, this is what's going on. So this misanthropy, in normal society there are these people who are haters of humanity, you know. Like if any of you ever remember reading Gulliver's Travels by Swift, which is a real, real indictment of the human race. Gulliver ends up living with these horses, you know, because he couldn't stand human beings anymore. And so then we talked about this punctiliousness, maintenance of primary loyalties through substitution of minor for major virtues. Boysen gives some example of the adulterous ministers who made fine points of teaching. And you see what Ramachandrapuri was, the same thing. The types, the isolated types are the legalist, the Pharisee, we talked about what a Pharisee is. A legalist, the prude. Prude, it comes from a French word actually, meaning good. Well, actually, good woman.
Prude.
In English, it comes to mean a person who is excessively attentive to propriety or decorum. You know, a super regard for modesty. Like the Victorian period was noted for pruditry. Where, for example, you couldn't say legs, you had to say limbs. Or where when people talking about eating chicken, they didn't call it breast, which referred to a part of a woman's anatomy also. They called it white meat, you know. And it was recorded in parts of America, a bull was called a gentleman cow. So this is pruditry, where people get, you know, people go around like it. And so sometimes I've seen it in ISKCON, you know, where people, the women always had their, you know, sari down over their faces and stuff like that. I went to one temple where there was this chastity crusade going down where actually you had a temple president who was actually severely compromised and was compensating by going this whole thing with chastity, and so women were stumbling around with their saris over their faces and all this stuff like that, and there was a real excess of pruditry in reaction. So that's what a prude is, very excessively concerned with appearance of propriety and modesty or righteousness to an excessive degree. Again, that's a kind of a substitute. Then he talks about diversion, the escape, and he discusses this reaction on page 155. The reaction pattern of diversion is a common and often wholesome way, so sometimes it's wholesome, of dealing with a sense of unworthiness, an inner sense of unworthiness. There's not frankness. You're not able, you feel unworthy, but you can't deal with it. And so now diversion. By a resort to activities of various kinds as work, play, travel, it may be possible to escape a troublesome conscience. So that rest or recreation or work may become a means of escape. So sometimes I think that the Krishna consciousness movement, sometimes you can become so busy spreading the Krishna consciousness movement that you don't have time to read a book, to chant your japa. And it may start as you kind of lose for some reason you've lost a taste for these things. And then you deal with it just by becoming busier and busier and busier. So this is something that can happen to all of us. I'm too busy spreading Krishna conscious to be Krishna conscious.
Someone was giving a Bhagavatam class the other day. So this is not the international society for spreading the
international
society for Krishna.
Yeah, that's right.
That was your class, right?
I didn't say that. Sorry.
Bhaja
Bihari said it. No, but it's very true, and it's happened. I've seen it all over the place. This is a very common one in ISKCON because we're basically extroverted. Prabhupada complained about this early on. You think my books are for distributing and not for reading. And actually, by being busy, you can kind of get some kind of public recognition as a great devotee while ignoring the really basics of Krishna consciousness. So this diversion, you know what the divert, you know? Diversion often means something you do for fun or pleasure in English. What are your diversions, you know, to distract you? But it just means to go away to one side. But the diversion of diverting the energies of Krishna consciousness actually becomes, and it says here, the attitude is restlessness. You know, so we can really get into a lot of travel too. We have that facility for travel and busyness. Now sometimes people can get overwhelmed. I understand that. But sometimes we use it. There was one former guru.